Good morning.
Good morning.
This way of doing the time change is pretty good, isn't it? It's the other way. It's not so good. So, I'm going to start out this morning with a quote from Dogen. A greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded. To understand that is the quintessence of practice. So when I was in college, I had an acting teacher named Gerald Hyken. And I played different roles in these little plays we had, these little one-act plays. And I was doing a spiritual practice, so I always wanted to play the nice person roles, the good guy roles. And my teacher, Gerald Hyken, said to me, "Well, you know, I have a meditation practice too." And my teacher said to me that if I really want to get a taste of the wisdom that's beyond form, I need to realize how awful I am. So I want you to play this role. I thought it would mess up my zazen. It would mess up my zazen. So this is our state, the human situation, that we all carry wounds. We all had traumas in the past that are still with us. And we kind of like to keep them at bay, right? We like to keep them at bay. And of course, now it's very socially acceptable to say, "I have PTSD. I mean, PTSD. I have PTSD." And that's cool. That's wonderful. That's a huge improvement. But Zen practice is about PTG, right? Post-traumatic growth. That's what Zen practice is about, because we all have trauma. We've all had trauma. To be live is to be alive is to have trauma. We all have karmic knots in our heads from some memory or something that keeps coming back. And in our meditation practice, it's possible for us to just see those knots, just be with them, just release them. And the unwinding happens on its own. It happens on its own. And in its own time, it allows the difficult experience to come up, to be there, and to complete itself. Turtle practice. One difficult experience at a time. And of course, these wounds that we have, our parents get blamed for. They get blamed for. And it's fine when we're kids, we blame our parents, but then when we're parents, we think, "Oh, God, what am I responsible for?" Then when we're grandparents, we're off the hook again. Being a parent was hard. Being a grandparent, you get to go home. So, but parents aren't perfect. No parents are perfect. And it's inevitable that since parents are wounded too, since human beings are wounded, sometimes parents are going to be absent, a little overbearing, maybe inappropriate. Maybe they failed to take some positive action at some point when we needed them to. Or maybe even our parent took too much interest in us, got too sort of involved in us, which my mom did with me to a degree. Took too much interest in me in a very positive way, but still. So because of experiences we have in our childhood and our adolescence with our parents or teachers or other significant others, scars are left, weaknesses are developed in our bodies, in our emotions. And if we don't acknowledge and make peace with those, then they we get caught by them forever. Those knots just stay. We stay knotted until we die. Until we die. So here we are on the cushion. We're all sitting on cushions, or in chairs, it's the same. On the cushion chair, on the chair cushion, I could care less. If we're just sitting, just doing our meditation, all thoughts and feelings can be received, just received. And we can develop a new relationship with our difficulty. Our difficulty can be our point of inspiration, our point of aspiration, and ultimately our point of deep understanding. So, in our meditation practice, we can begin to become alert to those times we find ourselves clinging, constricted from aversion, caught in wanting, and in our daily lives too. In our daily lives too. And our practice is just to notice the knot. Just to notice it. Is it a memory? Is it a frustration? Is it a sense that I lack the ability to do something? Just to notice the pain. And with compassion and equanimity and loving kindness, just to open the heart, soften the heart, surrender to what's true. It's true that I'm in this pain. It's true that there is this wound here. And by opening to it, we can be with whatever is arising. And the knot begins to dissipate. It's no longer a knot. No longer a knot. So we become less reactive. We become more flexible. It's not that we rewrite our history. You can go to narrative therapy and try to rewrite your history. That's cool. That's not what we do here, but that's cool. If you want to supplement this by going to narrative therapy and rewriting your history, do it. Do it. But rather for us, the self that experiences that history is gradually transformed, is gradually lightened up. When a trauma first presents itself, our feelings are generally not clear. Whether it presents itself when we're a child or when we're sitting on the cushion, something comes up. But luckily, all emotions are connected to our body. All emotions are felt in our body. So if we stay with just this, with these sensations, we're A-OK. We're A-OK. Our old stories are interpretations of how our childhood was supposed to be or how we are supposed to be drop away because we just stay with this. We just stay with this and we don't get caught by that other stuff. Little by little, little by little. I always say, if I can do it, you can. It's true. If I can do it, you can. Learning to live life hurts. Sorry, guys. Learning to live life hurts. Wounding is inevitable and necessary. Necessary. And depending on the severity of the trauma, depending on the context of the wound, depending on how it's handled, it can either move. We can move with it towards strength and wholeness, or ongoing frozenness. Frozenness. And of course, we don't want to. You know, a lot of people that I see in one-to-ones. By the way, I see people on Sundays in one-to-ones, and there's always a sign-up sheet out there. So please, if you'd like to see me, just sign up. But I see, you know, after I see them in one-to-ones for a while, sometimes after I've been seeing them for a year or something, they begin fessing up to me. The first year, they don't. Because they feel embarrassed about their woundedness. They shouldn't be that wounded. They've been sitting here for 2 years. They should be A-OK or 8 years. But gradually they start to fess up. Talk to me about their depression. You know, here they've been sitting, talk to me about their anxiety. They've been sitting like this for 2 years. You know, We don't want to. We're embarrassed. We're ashamed. But do the wounds of your friends, when your friend shares you with you their vulnerability, their wound, do you? How do you feel about them? Don't you feel encouraged by them, by their openness and the fact that they have the courage to share that with you? If they have the courage to share that with you, feel good about it. How about if you have the courage to share it with others? Or even share it with yourself, if not others. Meaning just your bare awareness, just recognizing it. Not pushing it away. We're all wounded beings in some way or another. That's our point of openness. Where we discover that the stillness that's not of time. Right here. So there's a Dharma teacher named Philip Moffat who talks about four functions of childhood growth. Four ways in which, as kids and adolescents, an ideal parent could perform, but a less than ideal parent, and all parents are less than ideal, is going to let us down, and we're going to get wounded. These are nurturing, protecting, empowering, and initiating. Nurturing, protecting, empowering, and initiating. Nurturing. So I was lucky to be present at birth of both of my kids. And they didn't like being born. Talk about a wound. It's just coming out of the womb is a wound. They yell like they're supposed to. But mother's breast was right there. She nurtured them right then. How long did it take? They cut the umbilical cord and then she put them to her breast. So there was that wound of just being born, but immediately she nurtured. Immediately. So we hope that parents will nurture us. And parents try. And they try to meet our physical and emotional needs. And then they try to celebrate our existence. That's part of nurturing. Wow. Wow, my son Jeff. Woohoo. Wow. Celebration. Celebration is part of nurturing. Delight in your child. It's part of nurturing. Part of nurturing. So I just went to Disney World to be with my grandkids in Orlando. And I just saw how hard my daughter works, but in a loving way. I'm telling them I'm being delighted at their company. showing them how delighted she is at them, even though they misbehave. She's still just delighted because they are. Doesn't mean she doesn't set boundaries. So we want to, through nurturing, we want to move into adulthood with a sense of innate worth and spontaneous joy. But sometimes the nurturing falls down. It's going to fall down, inevitably. If you didn't receive sufficient nurturing, you may have an inability to take joy in others or feel joy inside yourself. Well, so that's the wound that you're bringing to the cushion, you're bringing to the sofa. That could be it. Might not be. Maybe it lucked out. And of course, people come to meditation when they think they're old, like 50 years old. I'm too old to start. 50 or 60 years old. Too old. Simply too late. I'm broken. I'm stuck. I'm mired. I'm imprisoned. But that's your story. That's your story. We're not talking about stories here. We're talking about just being present with what is. I'm practicing bare awareness and loving kindness on the cushion or on the chair. And if our parents weren't as nurturing as we would have liked them to be, we can find teachers. We have a bunch of teachers here, in case you didn't notice. A bunch of teachers here. That's the first treasure. Buddha, teacher. We want our teachers, we want our role models to nurture us without creating codependency or excessively parenting us. And to be nurtured, we need a teaching. We need a dharma. We need teaching. And to be nurtured, we need others, to peers whom we could share our vulnerability with. It helps. It helps. Can't do this by yourself. You can do it a little bit, but really you can't completely do it by yourself. So that we can develop an inner nurturer. That's the goal, a nurturer. Nurturing. Second one, protecting. Parents protect. They protect. See that no physical or emotional harm comes to kids who are vulnerable. And all kids are vulnerable. So it's an incredible gift of feeling intrinsically safe, feeling trust, that we try to pass on to children. And my mother actually did pass it on to me quite well, but she, not so much to my sisters. She lost her temper with them, so they didn't feel safe around her. She lost her temper with me, but somehow, I don't know, I felt like I was safe with her. She was just meaner to my sisters. So a lot of you who do meditation practice, you're starting to do a meditation practice, you've been doing one for a while, maybe you've done a half-day retreat, and maybe you're going to try a whole-day retreat, then you see that we've got this Rahasya Sesshin coming up 7 days. And you think, God, I don't feel safe doing that. I don't feel safe. Maybe I'll feel safe doing a half-day. Yesterday, Wanda had more than 30 people come to 3 hours. 3 hours. So we shouldn't force ourselves, but if we don't feel safe just sitting down and looking at a wall and breathing and walking and eating for a while, it usually means that we have some unsafe feelings inside that we're projecting. We may have a memory of some traumatic environment or event, and it may come up in meditation or it may be subliminal. But why get scared about meditation? That's the only reason you get scared. Why get scared about coming here for a week? No big deal. We walk, we eat, we sit, we sleep. You might say, well, that's easy for you to say. Oh, I guess it is easy for me to say. And it takes daily meditation and then retreat time, periodic retreat time, to feel these wounds, to let go of the story about them, and to open up into the great stillness that's always here. Which means that the knot unravels. The knot unravels. And there's no magic bullet that will dissipate all our past trauma or create instant feelings of safety. It's our bare awareness of the fear, sense of loss and confusion as they're rising, and receiving those with compassion, with tenderness. Tenderness, your heart. I'm always asking people, where is your heart? Can you find your heart? And if we do this, the knottedness and the thoughts that just go over and over, and the intensity of the wound dissipates. Less intensity stays for shorter periods. And we feel some real steadiness, some real calmness. So, nurturer, protector. Next one is empowerer. Empowerer. Parents empower us. We try to empower our kids and grandkids. The nurturing and protecting was about doing for. The empowering is about not doing for, but helping the person be themselves, be separate, be independent, be self-confident. The Elizabethan age, Queen Elizabeth, the second half of her term, She empowered people. First half of her term, she was kind of, she had a hard time. I mean, she was, women, you know, weren't respected in that role. Things haven't changed much, have they? Weren't respected. Second half of her realm, she elevated her subjects and facilitated the beginning of their coming into their own power. That's what we want our parents to do. That's what we want to do with our kids. Right? Elevate them and facilitate the beginning of their coming into their own power. And then from power to a commitment to the child to become equal to me, even surpass me. That's what Queen Elizabeth actually was able to do, according to one historian I read. So this means the parent has to have a degree of self-confidence to do this, a degree of love to do this, and feel that it's her sacred duty, that it's his sacred duty to empower to the child. Empowered to try. Empowered to make mistakes. Empowered to be fully accepted. Then your interests are met with enthusiasm. The importance and joy of hard work is recognized. And failure is treated lightly. When the queen neglects or is afraid to allow the young their power, the kingdom becomes ill and languishes. Right? The kingdom is your family. The kingdom is your psyche. The kingdom is this community. This community. This sangha. Again, my own mother, was pretty good with me, but she was jealous of my sister. She thought my sister was beautiful, and my mother felt insecure herself, so she was jealous of her. Very hard for her to empower my sister. My sister still carries those wounds. I've been encouraging my sister to meditate for 30 years. But, you know, I'm the big brother, so who's going to listen to him? So when people come to me and they say, a retreat's just too hard for me. I can't do a full day. I can't do a full week. I honor that. I honor that. I have to honor that because that's where they are. But it's possible in their zazen to see what their wound is that makes them feel not empowered and help them be with that wound. So they can feel more empowered. More empowered. So slowly, we become unconditionally accepting in our zazen, in our bare awareness, of all this stuff, all these wounds, all the wounds, and all of the internal critics. The internal critic is just the internal parent in a rigid, authoritarian way. Criticizing, putting us down, bad-mouthing us, right? So, there it is. We just see it, we feel it, and we no longer identify with it because we just open our hearts and stay barely aware and come back to our sensations right here, our breathing right here. And we begin to discover this is not a myth. We begin to discover a happiness, a peace that's not dependent on conditions. It's not dependent on conditions. I've been up 14 days with good health and no Lyme's disease. Before that, I was down for, I don't know, how long? More, longer. So up and down. But the real happiness isn't based on whether I'm up or down, whether I have Lyme's disease or I'm here, yay. It's a stillness that's always here. It's a happiness that's always here. This is the core. But you have to practice as a turtle practice to do this, to touch this, to live with this. nurturing, protecting, empowering, and initiating. Initiating. Uh-huh. So what's initiation all about? Parents initiate us, supposedly, into the fact that we're a valuable and welcome member of the family, of society, of the world, that life has meaning, that we have a unique place in this universe, each of us, unique gifts and qualities. Our parents, one of their tasks is to initiate them, us. A girl, her mother treats her own womanhood and that of her daughter. Helps her daughter move into them. A boy, more often it's the father. If there's an absent father, maybe it's someone else who serves in that role, who is the primary initiator into manhood. I didn't have too much initiation going on in my family when I grew up. The closest I can think of is when my dad let me use his car, drive his car when I was 15 and a half, and then helped me, get a driver's license and then help me buy a car. He was trying to initiate me. He hadn't been taught. He hadn't been initiated himself into something larger. If you haven't been initiated yourself into something larger, it's hard to initiate someone else. So initiation, symbols, rituals, unspoken behavior. When it doesn't occur, we're still an adolescent in some way. We don't know what our place in life is. We don't know what our place in life is. We don't know what we're entitled to. We don't know what we're part of. We don't feel interconnected. You keep reading the scripture about interdependence, but it feels distant to you rather than feeling it in your souls. And so, there are all kinds of attempts to initiate that don't work too well, like getting a whole bunch of tattoos or getting a whole bunch of piercings and tattoos combined. That's not bad, but it doesn't really open you up to a sense of connectedness. Forming cliques, posses, gangs, carelessly risking their lives as teenagers do, using drugs, becoming a fundamentalist. Some way. And if we don't have parents to initiate us, and often we don't, maybe we have a grandparent. Maybe we have a relative. Maybe we have a teacher. I was kind of a lucky guy because my dad didn't know how to do this at all. But when I was not quite 21, I met my Zen teacher, Suzuki Roshi. And that was great. I lucked out. And so immediately he taught me about doing Zen practice, and I began getting initiated in Zen practice and in the wonderful interconnectedness that we feel. Although he kept telling me about it, and I thought he was just a word until I actually started feeling it. Unfortunately, we get attracted often to teachers and authority figures who don't want to empower us, who claim superior understanding. I've got it. You don't have it, Ted. I gave you Dharma transmission, but I shouldn't have done it. Because you really don't have it. You should sit for another 20 years. You know. Superior understanding. Create an impression of having vast authority. Not too long after I've been with Suzuki, I've been with Suzuki for a few years, this other Japanese teacher came up to me after a retreat where I had a really breakthrough in the retreat and said, "I saw what you experienced. You come practice with me. I've had many of these experiences. You come with me. Just in 1 year. 1 year." Suzuki said it when... So he tried to seduce me. And almost I got seduced. I almost left. Because we want a teacher who's going to really give us something. But that teacher doesn't want to empower us. They're not really empowering us. They have the power themselves. Do you understand? And because of their own inadequacy. So your mom and dad may have suffered, as I'm sure I did as a father, from these inadequacies. But that's okay. Parents do their best. Ancient communities had rituals, including those that taught you to take comfort in earth or nature. Now only a mom or a dad do the whole thing. That's pretty hard. So initiation begins with finding an identity within a family and a community. Then initiating into the wholeness of the self. We call this whole being Buddha nature. My whole being is Buddha nature. Just open to it. And it culminates in a sense of unity with all life. But you don't say, I feel one with all life. That's not it. You feel it. You feel just, I don't know. I can't tell you. So we're going to be doing an initiation here at Zen Center. We do it every 2 years. And we're going to be starting the process in February. And it's just an initiation, just one form of initiation. People saw one of these Roksus, and they get a Buddhist name, and they work with a teacher. And we have a ceremony next fall. So that's what we do here. That's what we do here formally. But informally, you could just initiate yourself in the practice and the community and have the same effects. I didn't get formally initiated until I'd been practicing for, 10 or 15 years, something like that. So nurturing, protecting, empowering, initiating, there's bound to be a hole in one of those. There's going to be a hole. And that hole is your opportunity. If you don't see the hole, you have no opportunity. You don't need to do zazen. Wisdom comes from having to cope. If you see it only as suffering, then you don't see that the glass is half full. That you can transform your parent wound into aliveness, into freedom. And if you lose that aspiration, you just hang out with a teacher here, and we'll help you get it back. You can have one of the teachers can be your mentor. That's fine. We do that here. We'd love to do that. Or you can come meet with me whenever you want, or both. Do it. Why not? So, we're stretching both our heart and our mind through our meditation practice, through our bare awareness and our loving kindness practice. And the personal, what we take so personally, begins to be impersonal. It's still there, but we don't take it personally. Oh, Matt dissed me. Oh, he doesn't like me. I must talk to Ted about him. Oh, it's just, Matt just had a bad day, that's all. Everybody gets a chance to have a bad day, right? We're all wounded. So what was done to us and not done to us rose out of a set of conditions. And wounds don't disappear, but they lose their charge. And in Zen meditation practice, we're not so interested in the content as the feelings and the sensations. You can go to therapy for content, but content is all about the nod what happened to you and when and how it keeps coming back and haunting you. And you might want to work with that in therapy. But on your cushion, we're working with right here. Right here. The felt sense, including the sensations and the feelings. Non-judgmentally, with an open heart and loving kindness. So then happiness that we discover isn't dependent on the past, present, or future. It's not dependent on any of those. I could be in Lyme's, have Lyme's, be in bed for the next 10 years and then expire like that. That's not happiness that's real. Isn't based on conditions. Do you believe that? Do you believe that? You think I'm just telling you a story? Because I want to be a Zen teacher or something. If you don't believe it, just practice and you'll discover it. You don't have to believe it ahead of time. Just discover it through doing your practice. And, you know, why are you here? Why are you all here today? Well, how many of you came because of some trauma? Some trauma forced you into the spiritual life, forced you to get on a cushion. Hey, congratulations to your mom for going out drinking when she was, should have been there with you. Congratulations. And I'm being only a little bit facetious here, but... So, embracing the parent wound. There's some insufficiency, always, in either nurturing, protecting, empowering, or initiating. And make that your teacher. And you don't have to figure out, oh, this is protecting. This is just something I read. Forget about it. Forget about it. Shining our light on each delusion. Loving and receiving love. Loving and receiving love. In this troubled world. So ending with Dogen again. A greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded. A greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded. So that's what I want to say. I'm glad to have as much conversation with you as you guys would like. Questions? Comments? Yes?
I just want to affirm this thing about being with the wound rather than trying to do something about it or with it. And I think... something happened for me this year where somebody just casually said to me, you know, you're just trying too hard. And that was so right on. So, and I could feel it just that I'm going to work it and I'm going to beat this thing. And I could just feel it melt. It does, you know, it takes a discipline of concentration, but it doesn't have to be this hard work and that comes from this fixing mentality that I think we all carry around.
Good, good. Wonderful that you've made that discovery. Wonderful. Could you guys hear him? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, all right. Thank you. What else? Hi, Francie.
Hi. I heard about the metaphor from the Theravada tradition of dipping of the cloth.
Can you speak a little louder?
In Theravada tradition, like the metaphor of dipping of the cloth when you sit in practice.
Of doing what?
Dipping the rag.
Oh.
Is that something that's also...
Dipping the rag into what?
Well, that when we sit, we are purifying the knots that you're calling knots.
Uh-huh.
And by sitting... We're dipping that in water, we're dipping our spirit or everything in water and cleansing those.
Oh, that's a good metaphor.
And I was just curious in Zen too. You were talking about.
Well, sure. I was just talking. I just didn't use that metaphor. I like that metaphor. Did you hear a metaphor? Could you guys hear it? Yes or no? No.
Can you tell them in a big voice?
It's called the dipping of the cloth and the dipping of the rag. And that when we sit in our practice, that we're cleansing those things that Tim is naming as knots, or the woundings are being cleansed as we sit in our practice.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're slowly unfolding.
That's right. That's exactly the case. Now, I just want to mention that often it doesn't feel that way. This is turtle practice. I always have to say that over and over again. Turtle doesn't make, when you look at a turtle, it doesn't look like the turtle's making any progress. Turtle's ever going to make it across the yard. I remember seeing a turtle there on the walk one morning, and then when I came back from sitting, it had moved two bricks toward the lake. Well, that's going to be your meditation practice. It's going to be, if it's not like that, there's something fake going on. So, but that's a beautiful metaphor. I like that. Thank you. Others? Nothing more? Anything more? Oh, yeah. Okay. Can you speak a little louder?
I was thinking that the turtle could be in enough pain that he might move a little quicker.
Well, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. The problem with the turtle is that the turtle is physically incapable of moving a little quicker, but the turtle can move with more determination, more focus, more acceptance of his limitation. And by doing that, he gets to the lake in one step, even though he's still on that brick. Because the brick is the lake. Because he feels it. Because he's so determined. He's so involved in just taking this one step. It's everything. It's everything. But unfortunately, the turtle is physically incapable of moving fast. Sorry. No, I'm not sorry. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit more about one of my experiences in Zazen more recently? I've kind of moved to longer sitting, and my mind is very resistant to allowing the feelings to come up. So it seems like right now for me what's happening is, you know, more thoughts, more thoughts, more thoughts, as to suppress the kind of feelings that I'm trying to let arise.
Yes, yes.
That's been my experience. I like keep wanting to feel.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, come on, let's feel here. And
yes.
It's just, I keep, my mind becomes more.
Yes, Well, that's very, very familiar kind of experience, what you're outlining, for my students and for me, when I was younger, for me. So what do we say about that? Well, I don't know what to say. I don't know what advice to give you, except that it's turtle practice, so often you feel like you're not making any progress and you feel like you're going backwards. And secondly, that you can build it, you can bring in specific loving kindness, specific self-compassion into your zazen when this is going on. You can actually learn a self-compassion practice, or you can do your own, so that you can not feel just so really discouraged by what seems to be a regression, because it's a regression. And it happens a lot in retreats, that people feel like they're regressing. That's why they only want to do a shorter retreat, because a longer retreat, they really trip out. They don't have any feelings. They're just thinking about their favorite meal over and over again. And they don't have to feel anything. You know? How long is it going to be till lunch? What's Ann cooking in there? I hope she cooks some good food. Oh, I wonder if I'll get an. I wonder if it's a rahatsu. Will it be time enough for me to eat all the good food? You know. So you regress when you meditate longer and deeper. You regress, and a lot of feelings and sensations come up, and you just think to keep a lid on things. So that's okay. You just notice that. Bring some loving compassion. Some loving kindness in, some self-compassion in. No. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Good. What if she said no? Then I'm inadequate as a teacher. Oh, my wound.
That when I get really stressed in a difficult situation, that's exactly what happens to me, that my head goes to the and it happens during the night as well as during the day. And I think for me, I would that my base calls a being what you were talking about, a non-nurturing.
A long what?
Non-nurturing.
Non-nurturing, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And the fear is what comes up, and the fear is what's creating this maelstrom of monkey mind, whatever. And it seems that the only way that I can actually move through it is actually not to sit in my mind.
Not to what?
Not to sit in my mind.
Not to sit in your mind.
No, but to be. To be in some kind of nurturing bodily activity, which might be something like yoga, that has that same element of being present, but being present in the body.
Well, that's wonderful. So let's not look at. I don't know if you could hear what she said. Could you guys hear her?
No.
Oh well. Do you want to say it louder, or do you want me to? You want me to say it?
Half the reason for all about this stuff. I was just saying that when I get into that monkey mind state. That often the only thing that will really break it is to go and do something nurturing within my body that makes me pay attention to my body, not my mind. And sitting, one is so clearly supposed to be paying attention to my mind. Although, you know, you are also taking but something like yoga or some kind of physical activity that actually pulls you into paying attention to body.
Exactly. Wonderful.
Is the only way for me to actually really shape that, and I'm not good at it. I'm really bad at it.
Well, that's wonderful. So you guys could hear her this time. So we don't look at this sitting on the cushion as the panacea, right? There's something in Japan which I don't think is around anymore because someone Googled it and it's not there, called Morita therapy. Morita therapy was the Zen approach to therapy, which was sitting, manual labor, walking, cooking, eating, manual labor, sitting, walking, manual labor. Now, they didn't have yoga, but your body, all about your body, all about being in your body and using your body to break up the knots.
Because I can do something called near dance.
Called what?
It's called near dance. It's a lot of new things.
Near
dance, and find myself crying when I'm doing it.
Well, that's wonderful.
You know, it's not easy.
Yeah. And now we have yoga during every day during retreat. A lot of people would think we should be, instead of having eight sitting periods and one yoga, they'd like to have eight yoga periods and one sitting. But that's not our way, partly because we're trying really to evoke the wound. We're trying to evoke the wound so that we can open up what's beyond it. Yeah.
Well, MBSR, which is also based on Buddhism.
Yeah.
They do combine the sitting and the body scan.
Yeah.
And the mindful movement.
Yeah.
And it's true that the body scan, being in the body, does.
Yeah.
And for people who are traumatized, it can actually sometimes be too much. So
yeah, that's true.
So if you have to figure out the balance.
That's right.
That's right. Very. And I think people tend to when we're anxious, some other culture tend to do the thinking. So in the middle of the night, the thinking is often. So if you can do a body scan.
So could you guys hear her? So some not too well. So she's just talking about mindfulness-based stress reduction. Jon Kabat-Zinn, I got training from him about 22 years ago. But he includes things like, in addition to sitting, you know, he was working with people who were in acute physical suffering in hospitals. His story is interesting in that. He went into these hospitals and none of the doctors wanted to work with him. But when he went to the acute pain areas, the acute chronic pain areas, the doctor said, fine, I can't do anything with him, work with him. So that's where he began teaching his meditation, people who had acute pain. Well, you may not have acute physical pain, but most of you have some acute emotional pain in that. Most of you do. He began doing that, and then he began teaching them to sit. They sat in chairs. They didn't have to sit in cushions. And then he began to teach them body scan, where you just lie on the floor, and you just pay attention to your entire body and all the sensations in your body. And then he began tape recording his voice doing that. And then they still had tape recorders. And he added yoga, and he developed this whole way of doing it. But it was working with people who were in extreme physical pain, or who the doctors couldn't do anything about. And now it's all over the world, I guess, right? Yeah. So that's right. So it's not just zazen. It's being in our bodies, being aware, and slowing down enough, if it's not zazen, slowing down enough in some other way so you can just be here. You know, I give talks about nature, but being in nature. And my newsletter out in the porch is all about Dogen and being in nature. Pema.
In the retreats that I've been in here for all these years, in the longer retreats, we do include yoga and walking outside.
I started sneaking that in 15 years ago, and then I snuck a little more in 12 years ago, and a little more 10, 8. But I added all that stuff, but I didn't decrease the sitting. Because I think it's important.
My question is, what is emotion? What is feeling? If it's not in the body.
What is emotion?
So
what is?
In terms of slow practice of the turtle, if you work, get through the body, your feelings, your sensations, and what the emotions do, can you not go faster?
You know, I couldn't hear you the last sentence you said.
Oh, I was wondering what really is emotion? What really are feelings?
Well, these are all just labels. So let's say that I'm feeling aggravated because you didn't speak loud enough. So I mean, that's my emotion. I'm just giving this an example. I'm not aggravated, but I'm just using this as an example. I'm feeling aggravated. She didn't speak loud enough, and so that's an emotion, aggravation.
What is that aggravation mean?
What is it? Mm-hmm. It's something. Something physiological. So that's why going back to the physiology is the root, and just
so
being with the physiology. Pardon?
Working through movement like yoga will make the turtle move faster.
My turtle doesn't move faster. Whenever we're trying to move faster, we end up. I want this. I want to get this. And then our inner critic comes in and says, God damn it, you know, you didn't do this, you should have done this. My turtle, that's not my turtle moves slower and slower.
I just wonder why we can't go faster.
I don't know, does anybody have the answer to that? Anybody want to?
I would say when you're actually moving, you're moving as fast as the turtle can go. So the alternative is that you're not moving at your full potential.
I would kind of say that if you want to go faster, you're focusing on getting someplace. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's not the objective. It's just being in the movement.
Oh, that's
recognizing,
right.
Synchronizing your mind.
That's right. Yeah, Jim.
I saw a bumper sticker on a VW bus once that said, "Too slow, too bad."
Okay, thank you very much.